You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful Davis day.
It is. It was a little hazy here in the Sacramento Valley yesterday. Okay, we've got to back up here. We're preparing the show on June 19th, 2024 for broadcast on June 20, 2024, which will be, I guess, almost technically the first show of summer. June 21. All right, one day shy. And we've been having some pretty mild, pretty sunny weather, although we did have a lot of smoke in the valley yesterday as we have a number of grass fires burning around the area. Cleared out pretty nicely with the Delta breeze coming in last night, and we are having some amazing temperatures here. Today's temperature, Wednesday, will be 85 degrees.
Okay. Oh, that is so low for some.
Yeah, well, it's nice. It's a little below average, yes. Tonight will be 51 degrees and mostly clear. Thursday, now we're going into a hot spell for the weekend. Thursday will be 90 and sunny, of course. Thursday night will be 55 and mostly clear. Friday, 97 degrees. And the National Weather Service defines that as hot, just so you know. Friday night will be 60 degrees and clear. Saturday is going to hit 101 and hot. Saturday night, 61, cooling off on Sunday to a high of 95, which is just a couple degrees above average high temperature for this time of year. Sunday night, 57. Monday, cooling back down to 92. Monday night, 55. And Tuesday, 94. So I do have to say, since people keep saying, boy, it sure has been hot this summer, and I just almost want to laugh. We've had, not really, we've actually had, in the last week, 7 days ago, we were in the upper 90s, and then it cooled down and we didn't even get above 90 for 5 days in a row. So it's been a couple hot days, and we're getting into our usual summer pattern here in the Sacramento Valley. The high pressure builds, you're hot for a couple days, maybe in the upper 90s, maybe low 100s for a day or two. The breeze comes back in off the ocean and we cool off. The nights are in the 50s, maybe 60 degrees, which is really pleasant because, folks, I don't know if you're reading the news, but everybody back in the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic are just sweltering with a massive heat dome that's sitting over them. Just the people right on the coast back there are escaping this extraordinary heat that they're looking at. Friend in Ann Arbor, Michigan is looking at 99 degree temperature, which in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with their humidity, is going to be a health issue. I mean, seriously. So, okay, we get hot here in the summer, and I'm sure it will happen sometime this summer that we'll have one of those, you know, multi-day heat waves. But this has been utterly perfect weather for your tomato plants. We have had perfect.
Wait, no. I thought tomato plants didn't set fruit when it got over 90.
Correct. And we have not been above 90 for 5 days in a row now. And the tomato plants are flowering. So yeah, you got a day or two close to 100 or over 100. And then we have 4 or 5 days where it's below 90. So generally speaking, at least for the tomatoes that are well established and growing and blooming, you should be getting good fruit set and fruit development right now. So the weather for the next few, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'll ask you about the blossom indra.
Yeah, so the weather for the next few days, we're going to have another hot spell for a couple of days and cooling back down into the low 90s, and the nights are going to be in the mid 50s, so very rather what I would call balmy summer conditions here. Of course, no clouds, of course, no rain on the horizon. I don't think we'll be talking about rain probably for another, 3 months. So summer weather is lovely here, and if you are not accustomed to the Sacramento Valley, this is really typical. A little cooler than average, actually, right now is what we're experiencing with these interspersed days or day or two over 100 degrees. You had a question.
Yes. What about blossom end rot? I'm hearing about that lately.
Yeah, somebody posted a picture already on local Davis Facebook group of blossom end rot on her Roma tomatoes. And first of all, Roma, just so you all know, although it's a very popular tomato variety because it's a compact grower and is very productive here, it is, we like to call it practically the canary in the coal mine with respect to blossom end rot. It is very susceptible to it on the first fruit that's set. Now, others, I'm sure, will be showing it. I made a note on my calendar about 7 or 8 weeks ago when we were having temperatures that were well below average. And I always do this, and I mark the calendar 8 or 9 weeks out and just write blossom end rot question mark, and like clockwork, it always shows up. These plants that are showing blossom end rot on fruit that's ripening now, if you count back to the development
Ripening now.
now, that's when you mostly see blossom end rot, is when the fruit ripens. This is the one where the bottom of the fruit, hence the name blossom end, is soft and gushy, and the fruit tends to spoil. You could cut out the bad part and use the rest, but it tends to really kind of spoil the whole thing. It occurs earlier than full ripeness. You can see the early symptoms of blossom end rot 2 or 3 weeks before the fruit ripens, if you know what you're looking for. But it just looks like a little bit of mottling down on the bottom of the fruit. And then as the fruit reddens and ripens, the bottom gets soft and gushy. It's just, it's discouraging because it's the very first fruit that sets. We know that it is primarily correlated with low temperatures and soil moisture. Too much moisture, too much water when the soil is cold is what it usually comes down to. Lots of other things appear to be correlated with it. However, I guarantee if you post a picture of blossom end rot anywhere, the first 10, 20, 30 comments you'll get from people will be about calcium. Because many years ago, research indicated a correlation between calcium deficiency somewhere in the soil, in the plant, or something. And blossom end rot. And so our industry, the nursery industry being what it is, products were rushed to market for you to provide calcium to your plants, right, in the form of a soil drench or something to put on the surface. Or people would recommend gypsum, which is a calcium product, or they would have you spraying the plant with a foliar calcium spray. And even this is 40 plus years ago, this one, we first opened our business in 1981. I kept thinking, our water in Davis is so full of calcium that if you have a drip system, you have a ring of calcium deposits on the edge of the wet zone. We clearly are not deficient in calcium in our water or in our soil. And so the people who were up on the research said, oh, no, it's not a problem with calcium deficiency in the soil. It's an internal problem in the plant. So we were then supposed to sell them liquid calcium sprays. They really dug in and did a bunch of research on this to using a tracer, essentially, to see exactly where and when in the plant the apparent calcium deficiency would occur. It was in the pedicel, the thing, the stem that holds the fruit, is where they had first found what appeared to be a calcium deficiency. Why would that matter? Because calcium is an important part of cell wall construction. It's part of what makes cell walls strong. And the blossom end is the furthest point from the roots. It's the furthest out from where it would be doing calcium uptake. So you would expect, by correlation, a deficiency in calcium to lead to this problem in the fruit. But then they observed that the apparent deficiency of calcium in the plant showed up after the symptoms of blossom end rot. So it was part and parcel of the whole thing. It was just another symptom of the same problem. Calcium deficiency, calcium movement in the plant wasn't the trigger of blossom end rot. It reflected the same problem: uptake of cations by the roots, mobility of cations within the plant, and so forth. It's a physiological disorder related to temperature. That's the simple, simple answer. You can make it a lot worse by putting a whole bunch of positive ions in the soil. If you put a half cup of Epsom salts under that plant, you could make blossom end rot worse, not better, because Epsom salts are a positive ion, magnesium. You might be suddenly affecting the soil chemistry. Don't play around with soil chemistry unless you have a known deficiency. This is not a deficiency in the plant. It's not a deficiency in the soil. Adding Tums under the plant will not solve it. Putting eggshells in the soil will not solve it. Nothing will solve it, actually, except watering correctly and being patient. And here's the good news: the plant is not affected. The next fruit is typically not affected. So just be patient, throw those out, pick them off, throw them away. The next fruit will typically come out without a problem, at least in our climate, where the temperatures become more what the tomato plants prefer.
So, if I am one of those people who doesn't believe Don, and leaves the stuff on the internet instead.
Yeah.
And I have a tomato with blossom end rot, and I drench that thing in calcium.
Yeah.
And pick off that bad tomato. Hey, yeah. The next ones are just fine. So the calcium must have done the trick.
Clearly, as we say frequently, placebo effect is alive and well in the field of horticulture. Almost anything you do will solve the problem, because the problem solves itself. Water deeply, water correctly, and please don't mess around with applying this, applying that, because you can actually make things worse.
And the real issue here is, they planted their tomatoes 2 months ago when it was too cold.
Yeah, if you count.
Right. So just plant later and you won't have blossom end rot problem.
If you count backwards, the fruit that's ripening now probably set 8 weeks ago. So this is the middle of June. That fruit set in late April, which means the plant was planted in early to mid-April, which this year was just too cold. I mean, that's, this is why we harp on this. And one of the comments I always make when people ask me, why are you so vigorous about telling people not to plant early? Couldn't you sell more tomato plants if you just say, yeah, sure, fine, February is great? Aside from the possibility of a late frost, the issue is that the first fruit is very commonly, unfortunately, spoiled by blossom end rot. But again, the good news is this doesn't affect the plant. The problem just corrects itself. Soil temperature gets where it needs to, at least here in the valley, because we can, we warm up and the soil warms up. Some of you listening at higher elevations or different states, you might have cold soil later in the season. So you might be dealing with blossom end rot on subsequent fruit that develops as well. But remember, it is almost entirely related, as far as we know. It's an internal issue in the plant. It's a physiological disorder. It's not a deficiency of soil in the soil. It's not something you can correct. It's really that simple, other than watering deeply, not keeping the plant too wet when the soil is cold, and just being patient. It will outgrow. The next crop will almost certainly be fine. And again, Roma is a really good example. Roma sets really well. You'll get a lot of fruit on a Roma plant. They're very popular because they only get 2 to 3 feet. It's a very compact plant, produces 30 or 40 fruit in a good year here in the Sacramento Valley. People often plant them without staking or caging them because they really don't need it. They're that compact, and you'll get plenty. And you'll get them kind of all at once. These are the first sort of rogue fruit that's set. The ones that come on next will all ripen kind of together over about a 4 or 5 week period. You can harvest and be done and can them and use that space for something else. So Roma is a really good variety, but you do sometimes have this issue with the first ones that set, especially if you plant a little early.
Two questions. First, is it too late to plant tomatoes now in the middle of June?
No, you can still plant. As the season goes along, we change our inventory. As a retailer, I start phasing out 2 or 3 weeks ago the very large fruited types, the ones that take longer to ripen and so forth. And we would steer you towards, let's say, 4 to 8 ounce fruit, like Early Girl. Cherry tomatoes, of course, plenty of time for them. They set and ripen very quickly. We can plant all the way through June, and there's even varieties you can plant right on in through July. And as I've said before, every year I do this test, where I take some of our throwout tomatoes at the end of our retail season, take them home, stick them in the ground, see what they do. So far, the latest that I've done that, and I usually do 4 just as a test because I have room for it. And I try to do a hybrid and an heirloom and something new and so forth, a reasonable sampling. The latest I did it was last year or the year before. I did August 1, right? 4 tomatoes, August 1. For this, I put them on the water line that's running with my peppers and cucumbers, because that runs frequently. And these are plants going in August, so I figure they need all the help they can get. I don't put them on the line with the tomatoes, because by August, I'm watering the tomatoes once a week really deeply, and that wouldn't be enough for the newly planted plant. I'd have to go out and hand water them. So I put them on the line with my other regular vegetables, you might say, which may be watering every couple of days. And each of those 4, without respect, by the way, to whether it was hybrid or heirloom, gave me about 20 fruit. In October, planted August 1, mid-October, I was picking about 20 fruit. I didn't do any super large ones. Maybe that'll be my experiment this year. One of the 1 pound fruit, does it really have time to grow and ripen a fruit that big if you plant it August 1? And no, I'm not saying August 1 is the time you should be planting your tomatoes. We'll get to that topic in a moment with one of the comments that is in today's program.
All right. I could do the soil temperature question now, or we could finish up our intro part. Let's finish our intro part.
Well, first of all, KDRT is community radio. That means we're public radio and you're the public. So if you like the show and you like to help support it, you can always head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. We just got done here at KDRT with the Davis Music Fest, which is a great big 3-day event that Davis Media Access was out there broadcasting. And one of our programmers sent a note that he wasn't able to be at the Davis Music Fest, but he did want us to know where he was. He was at the Grass Valley Father's Day Bluegrass Festival. And this is Rocky Outcrop. We call him Craig, but his DJ name is Rocky Outcrop, a new programmer doing a bluegrass show here on KDRT. And while he was at the Grass Valley Father's Day Bluegrass Festival, he says, I scored a really big in the world of bluegrass interview with the festival headliner, Allison Brown. Allison is a multi-Grammy winning IBMA banjo player of the year, owner of Compass Records, producer, all-around bluegrass progressive acoustic, I can't say this word. Artist. Cool. She gave a fantastic interview, and I will be packaging it to play, he says, during the next Yolo County Breakdown show, which will air Friday. That's this Friday at 10 a.m. And if you happen to be listening to the Saturday show or a podcast, it's going to repeat at Saturday at 5 p.m. and it repeats Monday at 11 p.m. So if you have the ability to give a shout out to this interview, he says to me as a fellow programmer, give my thanks. Well, here you go, Craig. Her next album, which is being mixed for release now, features, get this, Willie Nelson, Dolly Parton, you got me right there, Billy Strings, Drew Emmett, and more. This is heavyweight bluegrass and country stuff if you don't know who all these people are. That's from Rocky Outcrop. Here's one thing you all don't know about me. I have an autographed picture of Dolly Parton on my wall.
Ooh, done. Next time we're on Zoom, I want you to show me that picture.
Okay. All right.
This is cool. All right. So thank you for that announcement. And that is our public service announcement for the day, I believe, isn't it?
That's it. Yep.
Then I can jump right back into this other thing, which ties into what we were talking about. And this is from Jane, who is up at Fair Play, California. That's elevation 2,300 feet. Kind of high for us. USDA Zone 9A.
Yeah.
Dear Don, I followed your advice this spring about waiting to plant cucumbers and eggplants until the nighttime air temperature indicated that the soil temperature was warm enough. For the start of June, at the night temperatures have not risen above 58 degrees. Yeah. I protected my plants with walls of water or large stones around the base, which I removed after our recent heat wave. However, the last several days of cooling have seen nighttime temperatures drop to 43 degrees, 45, 46, and last night, 38 degrees. Can I expect my cucumbers to be stunted by this? Should I start more seed? Please help.
Yeah, well, both of those things are possible. Yes, it's a short exposure to cold temperature. Cold injury is both cumulative and reversible. I like to say that because each night that it happens injures the plant. Each warm day reverses that to some extent. So as long as your daytime temperatures are fairly close to normal, the plant will probably be okay. But anything below 40 for a tropical or subtropical summer vegetable is not going to be optimal, unfortunately. I don't think they'll be injured that much, but it isn't a bad idea to do sequential plantings of cucumbers anyway. And I really have been perhaps remiss in not mentioning this. I grow a lot of cucumbers. Everybody around me likes them. And we find that many of the older varieties, especially, you plant them, they grow great, they set, they do that for 4 to 6 weeks. And then that vine is kind of played out. It really, you know, the lemon cucumbers, especially heirloom types, they don't continue all summer. By the time you get another month down the road, the plants are struggling with mildew or whatnot. But when I have, as you're, you know, considering, started some seed and planted another crop 3 to 4 weeks later and another crop 3 to 4 weeks later, bearing in mind that cucumbers can start producing as little as 30 days after you plant them, as long as your season continues into early September, you can plant cucumbers as late as perhaps mid-July. And that's not a bad plan for people here in the Valley as well. I will say, one of the reasons I've shifted over personally more to the burpless and Persian cucumbers is I have found those vines seem to me to be more vigorous and to continue longer. So I've been happy with those that they continue producing. But what I have found, once again, those like old plants that the garden center is about to throw out, I'll sometimes take one home well after the other cucumbers are already in their peak of production. I'll stick it in on a line that I know will be running frequently because you're going to have to water it a lot. That water can is out there just in case it's the only thing that needs water that morning. But I put it on the high water line and they come in and produce and yield more heavily, more vigorously, shall we say, than the ones that were peaking out a couple of weeks prior. So it is a good idea to sequentially plant, or if you want to, just do another crop just for that purpose alone here in the valley. However, in your situation, it might be good insurance as well, because your night temperatures sound pretty problematic. I would say that would be a great thing to do. I can only say you'll see, when it comes to what's going to happen to those plants. Protecting them now, since I'm assuming they're up and pretty vigorous and hard to cover, not only probably not necessary, probably not practical, just see what happens, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to get another crop going. And if you start the seed in the third week of June, you'll be planting those plants out in the first week of July and harvesting from them probably end of August, early September. At your elevation, that of course will be the end of your season. But I think it would be worth doing if you have the space for it, and it's worth doing here in the valley. Sequential planting isn't a bad idea with determinant tomatoes, we'll get into that in a moment, cucumbers, and especially green beans. I found personally that green beans would struggle midsummer, do great at the first part of the season, and do great at the end of the season. But in the heat, they would grow just fine, but the flowers would set what appeared to be beans, and then they would be blank, or they just wouldn't set at all, because beans are somewhat sensitive to high temperature. So another one where sequential plantings work. Personally, I use bush beans for that because they're convenient, but if even pole beans will give you another crop. Learned this from a customer many years ago. She would come in buying seed in August for beans. And I would say, seems late to plant beans. She would say, I always plant beans in August for the Thanksgiving crop. So she would plant them in August to be harvesting in October, storing them, whatever, and having them for Thanksgiving dinner. And her experience was the same that I ultimately came around to, which is that midsummer isn't great for green beans. So just, finish harvesting the first batch, take them out, put in another batch in August. You'll be harvesting those late September, October, even into November here in the Sacramento Valley. Do consider sequential plantings of some of your summer vegetables.
So Don, there was a comment that I recently heard about when it's too cold to plant something, but you plant it anyway, and walls of water, which we've talked about on the show before, to keep it warm. But this person suggested that they could put out stones next to the base of the plant. And is that a heat sink? Is that
They do. I've read about this. I've never seen double blind studies or anything, but rocks warm up during the daytime and release that heat. And so they would provide some extra heat, presumably. There's nothing wrong with all of that. Walls of water work great. If you're at a high elevation, high latitude, and you're having trouble figuring out when to get going in the spring, and you think you've got it all figured out, and then the temperature dips back down low, walls of water are a device which you fill these tubes that are connected with water. You stand it up around the plant. It essentially looks like a little cone, and it sort of falls in on itself, making a miniature greenhouse. And we used these, just set one up at our nursery many years ago in February to see how well they would work. And we put a little thermometer in there. On a day in February, the temperature inside the wall of water was 85 degrees. And so that can make a big difference and can warm the soil up and can keep it consistently warm. Our only concern would be, if you leave it on too long, it might get too hot in there. But if the vine is vigorous enough, it would shade the thing. And presumably you do take them off at some point. But for those of you living in places with wildly fluctuating springtime temperatures, walls of water or similar devices can be very effective. They're even more effective than just a little, covering the plants with a hot cap or a little thing of plastic, or I've even heard of using 2-liter soda bottles. Those all work like a mini greenhouse, but this has the advantage of the water retaining moisture, high warmth all the way into the night and warming up the soil. They do work. They're amazing. They're not common. You may have to go online to order them nowadays. They do hold up well. When we did use them, they lasted for several years, but they do make a big difference. So those of you with the dicey spring temperatures, consider walls of water.
And the stone idea, if I were to plant in the ground, which of course I don't, but if I were and I put stone, like I don't know, pebbles or something around the plant, that would make it hotter in the spring. But wouldn't it be harmful in the summer when it gets really hot?
Yeah, she pulled them away. This is really important for those of you who are landscaping. It's very common to see gravel and rock as a soil covering in coastal areas and desert areas for some reason. To me, that they're a nightmare in the valley, because if you have a whole big area of rock, it just gets hotter. And if she's not talking about that. She was talking about putting plant, you know, rock, big stones near the plant just for that purpose, and then pulling them away as temperatures increase. Now, I don't know that her temperatures would get high enough actually to be a concern with what we're discussing here. But yes, the surface you choose, the soil mulch that you choose, and we can call rock a mulch, does affect the air temperature considerably. And if it reflects, then it's going to be higher air temperature, and you can actually affect your crop. I had a customer who was having a problem with four tomato plants. He plants a bunch of them all around his house. This was a few years ago. And four of them were growing like crazy, but not producing. They'd flower and the flowers would just fall off, you know, as they do when it's over 90 or over 100, you know, they have many of the flowers, most of the flowers will fall off in high temperatures. This was all summer. They were just falling off. And he finally sent me a picture. He had planted them on the west facing wall of his house, and they were growing great. And not a single
over 90.
It was over 90 in that bed every single day, no matter what the official weather service high temperature was. He was cooking them. It was just too high temperature for the plants to pollinate correctly. So you can, you know, we always talk about microclimates. Well, he had inadvertently chosen a microclimate that's actually one of our most difficult microclimates here in the valley. West facing wall that has no shade. You only get half day sun, but the half you get is really hot. And that, you know, when it's 105 degrees, that wall is probably more than that. And the air around the plant is more than that. Tomato plants don't care. They looked great. They were growing fine, as we kept joking. If you had to use for tomato foliage, this would be fantastic. But you didn't get a single fruit on them. So microclimate can make a big difference. And that applies to those of you at higher elevations, obviously. You know, if you always have this problem with a late spring cold temperatures, look for that one place around your house that maybe traps a little more heat. You're dealing with a different issue than we are. Your issue is not enough heat much of the season. Our issue here is we suddenly get into high temperatures and we can actually get, you know, to the point where the plants are not setting, as in the gentleman who happened to choose that west wall. We chatted about what he could plant in a west-facing wall, rosemary, herbs, kitchen herbs, you know, basil, you know, some sweet basil is fine with that. There's a lot of things that would be fine, but I wouldn't plant tomatoes there, and I wouldn't plant peppers there because almost all the fruit would scorch. So you have to choose your plants carefully for that west facing wall here in the Sacramento Valley.
All right. Here's another question that's just come in. This is from Anne in Medford, Oregon.
Yeah.
Hi, I am up here in the Rogue Valley of Southern California. No, Southern Oregon. Oh, excuse me. I want to plant some ceanothus variety not yet chosen. I was thinking it would be best to plant in the fall before the rains begin. Is this a good idea? Also, if I do this, will I need to water the first summer? I know they are incredibly xeric, so I do not plan to add irrigation to it once it's established. The placement will be on a bank with full sun, clay soil, which was once home to two valley oaks, which are now gone. And we live in zone 8B, but because we are 600 feet above the valley floor, our microclimate is a bit drier than down below. Please advise.
Well, I do know ceanothus are grown in Oregon. That's a beautiful area, by the way. One of my favorite parts of Oregon is the drive from Highway 5 to the coast along the Rogue River, which you can do by taking the Agnes to Galice route. Check it out sometime. It's a windy road. It goes over the mountains. My kids would always say, oh, we're doing one of these roads again, are we, Dad? Yep. And it winds its way down. You go all the way to Gold Beach. And so the Rogue Valley is quite a range of climates, but she mentioned Medford. So Medford is interior, not if you're in Gold Beach, I don't know how you're growing tomatoes. It's cold and foggy all the time. But if you're up in or ceanothus or any of those things, but if you're further inland, yes, there are ceanothus you can grow. Oregon State, by the way, has some great information on ceanothus varieties at the OSU website. So you can look up the ones that they mention. And I would check locally. This is a big issue for us. There's all these ceanothus varieties, and everybody wants to ask this, that, or the other. So there's only one species native here in Yolo County, and ceanothus in general in our soils are very relatively dense, rich soils that hold nutrients and hold moisture, grow fast, and die young. That's just the way, the characteristic pattern of many of our woody California natives here. But you're in a place where you should be able to grow them, because you've got a slope, you're on a bank, water will percolate away. Even with your higher rainfall that you get up there, water will not be standing around the plants. That's really important. So it sounds like you have a very good location for it. Yes, generally speaking, native plant enthusiasts will tell you fall is the best time to plant, or in California, frequently winter is even better because your rains are more assured. If you don't get rain shortly after planting in, let's say, October, which is a very common planting month for California natives here, you will have to hand water them until we get at least 1 to 2 inches of rainfall. Then you don't have to do anything typically at all until the first summer. Yes, we do irrigate the first summer. People are posting pictures right now of native plants they put in last fall. They're posting them in local Facebook groups here in Davis, and also on the California Native Plant Society Facebook page, which, although I know you're in Oregon, you might find it a very helpful page. It's got a lot of really active participants who can give you advice on this. And very commonly, I'm looking at these pictures as one of the people who goes in there and answers questions, and they need water. I mean, it's still newly planted. It does need irrigation. Not as frequent as common landscape plants or flowers or vegetables or anything like that, but a good soaking, let's say every 2 weeks, depending on your soil. And by good soaking, I mean a few gallons of water all at once, preferably. Drip works, although it's not preferred for native plants because it can lead to susceptibility to crown rot. But if that's what you've got, work with it. Infrequent irrigation, but it does need irrigation during the first summer, at least in our area. And I'm almost certain in Medford, Oregon, you would also need to irrigate during that first summer. And then my experience has been you then back off, and by the second summer, you're irrigating half as often and twice as long. And native plants that I've put in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years ago, I generally am hardly watering at all, or maybe once a month during the course of the summer, just because we are so hot and dry and dusty, which may or may not be a problem for you in Medford. I do go out and I follow the Los Politos wet watering technique, where he stands there, he opens a can of beer, I'll do it with a big thing of iced coffee, and you stand there washing the plant off for as long as it takes you to drink that. Okay. Overhead watering it, and you're washing the leaves and they're dripping down onto the roots, and you stand there a few more times, you finish your beverage, that's enough for that plant. And it's giving it the equivalent of a Southern California rainstorm. Yes, they do get rainstorms in Southern California in the summer. They're quick, they're fast moving, they're spin off from monsoon rain, so they can sometimes be pretty intense, and then that's it. They don't get anything more for several weeks. They do seem to benefit from that, and particularly getting the leaves washed off. I started doing it mainly because of ash and dust, but I think there's other benefits to it. They aren't completely xeric in the sense of having no water in the summer, but they shouldn't be watered frequently because of their vulnerability to crown rot. So water the first summer, half as often, twice as long the second summer, maybe once every month or so during the third summer, depending on the plant's performance. The pictures people are posting are plants where older leaves are yellowing and dropping, and leaves on the west side of the plant are scorching. That's drought. I mean, that's sunburn caused by drought. And most recently, someone posted a picture of a ribes doing that. They've posted pictures of ceanothus doing that. A lot of native plant folks will jump in and say, that's normal, that's natural. And I will say, yes, but the plant will perform better if you don't allow it to become stressed that way. So don't overwater, but don't completely withhold water after, you know, in the first summer after planting, second summer after planting. You can back off after that. I've seen plenty of landscapes where no irrigation is occurring. But in general, these woody natives do benefit from having their foliage washed off. And maybe, let's say, 3 irrigations during the course of a normal summer certainly is helpful. It's easy to kill them with overwatering, which is a frequency issue. You can give a really deep soaking every few weeks, and the plants will generally perform better if you're in a hot interior climate.
So on Medford, I'm not familiar with that area. Do they get summer rain, or are they dry all summer like we are?
The Willamette Valley, it's a dry summer. It's just summer. Milder. We drove out of Davis when it was 105 degrees at one point, and pulled into Medford, and they kept saying, oh, you ought to come back when we're not having a heat wave, because it was in the, you know, upper 80s. We just left a heat wave, folks. This is great. So Willamette Valley is a wonderful, wonderful place to garden. You can grow cool California and Oregon natives. You can grow all kinds of fruit trees. Berries do incredibly well there, but they do need summer irrigation.
All right. Well, before we continue with our things from the mailbag, I have a question, comment, request personally. We went on vacation for a week to Clear Lake, which is up in the hills. And then we kept driving on Highway 20 all the way over and went down to the ocean. Well, there's no beaches there. It's like cliffs kind of thing.
Well, there's beaches, but
there's the Mendocino Botanical Garden.
Yes.
And so I went there. Oh, it's so pretty.
Yep.
And there's so many beautiful things growing. So I took a few pictures. Well, you know, maybe 15 or so. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to come into your store at some point and show you the pictures and ask you if you know what they are and if I can grow them in Davis. You know, and the answer may be I haven't got a clue, or the answer may be, oh, you're out of luck. They have to be within sight of the ocean. So, but I tried to pick things that, you know, looked like they should grow here. They had so many different colors of California poppies. It was astonishing. Anyway, if anyone out there is going to end up on Highway 1 over by Fort Bragg, I encourage you, go over to the Mendocino Botanical Garden.
Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens in Fort Bragg have been a destination for me for 40 years. And I've watched that garden expand and increase their collections of things that are very appropriate to that incredibly coastal environment, which is essentially 60 to 65 degrees pretty much year round. I was there once when they were having what they thought was a heat wave because it was in the low 70s and the people looked like they were going to pass out on the streets. But, it was sunny. I had gotten over there, gone to the Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens, took a bunch of pictures in the usual fog overcast they have, which is beautiful. The next day we woke up and it was sunny. We thought, we're staying another day. We're going back to all those places we went the day before and taking all new pictures. If you like dahlias, make a point of heading to Fort Bragg, north of Mendocino, Mendocino Coast, there on Highway 1. Right around Labor Day or thereafter, the dahlia display garden with at least 100 or more plants is spectacular, but they need the heat to really get going. So while our dahlias are beginning to bloom here in the valley, they're several weeks away, but the display is phenomenal, and you've never seen such array of sizes and shapes and colors. They also have one of the most amazing heather collections that you will see anywhere on the coast of California. By heathers, I mean Ericas, Dabuishas, Calunas, true heathers, the kind of thing you'd see in Scotland. Well, if you want a climate pretty darn similar to Scotland, Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens is the place for you. And I'll say, no, none of those with very, very limited exceptions do well in the valley. So you should just go over there and enjoy them. The other thing I will say, since I've been going over there since we had no kids, young kids, older kids, and so forth, it's a great place if you happen to have younger people with you, because there's these long paths that go practically to the beach or out over the cliff, and places they can run and not bother anybody. They can run through the place while you, the horticulturist, are poking along slowly and driving them crazy. Really, it is the jewel of the North Coast, because I can't think of a botanical garden anywhere up or down Highway 1 that's comparable. And it really is beautifully suited and situated to that constantly foggy, overcast climate that is Fort Bragg. Takes a little getting used to, but once you've been there for a day or so, you all see all these people out walking around in shorts and down vests, the classic California combination.
Well, I think we must have hit an odd day because there was sunshine.
Yes, it happens.
It wasn't foggy. And it was a great afternoon. We had a really good time.
Yeah, they used to have a rose garden. The various times I've been there, they have a big gazebo area where they let local garden clubs come in and display, like the Begonia Society, or the one time we were there, the Ivy Club, which had all these interesting and fascinating forms of ivy. The Begonia Society, the fuchsia folks back before fuchsia might decimated fuchsias all up and down the coast. So there's always something going on. And of course, lots of art in the garden as well. Yeah, definitely check it out online if you haven't gotten over there, Mendocino Coast Botanical Garden. And unfortunately, the answer to your question about many of those things is no, they don't grow here in the valley. But when you first walk in, there's an expansive perennial border. Most of those plants are fine almost anywhere in California. So there are things that you can learn and jot down and go buy at your local garden center at the interior. Be cautious about buying things over there and bringing them back, just because you better look them up first. There's a lot of things that really want that foggy, coastal, windy climate, and that ain't us. So,
well, now getting back to our regular scheduled program.
Back to your programming.
So Don sent me a note, and this is about Get Growing with Farmer Fred, which is a show that Farmer Fred does, right?
Yeah, it was a broadcast show on KFBK and KSTE, actually KSTE Talk Radio, and then both of those stations went fully automatic. So Fred went to full-on podcasting, and Get Growing with Farmer Fred is available as a podcast. You can also find it. He's on Facebook and places like that. So just look for Get Growing with Farmer Fred. I've known Fred for years and years and years.
And the website is gardenbasics.net, yep. By the way. All right. This year's garden experiment is coming along as forecast. Problem area? Planting in barrels in the side yard, an area which gets way too hot in the afternoon.
Hey, this sounds familiar. We're just talking about that.
Warm season plants, especially tomatoes and peppers, don't last through the summer there. Don Shore of Redwood Barn Nursery in Davis recommended planting an early ripening determinant variety. Harvest it in early summer and then replant in the barrel with something that can take the heat in that location. Popcorn has done well there, for example. This is a bush early girl tomato, a determinant that allegedly ripens in 54 to 65 days, producing good size 6 to 7 ounce tomatoes. Today is June 17th. The plant was started from seed in February and transplanted into the barrel mid-April. Today, we harvested the first ripe bush early girl. The rest look to be less than a couple of weeks away. So if the majority can be harvested by the first week of July, that's perfect timing for the popcorn seeds who are standing by. Thanks for the tip, Don.
One of these days, I'm going to go through Fred Hoffman's discussion of how to grow popcorn, because he's been growing it for years, and it's really fun if you have the room for it. But there are some special conditions for growing popcorn. This is actually, I had forgot that this was the West Side hot exposure, which was just exactly what we were talking about a little earlier in the program with a gentleman who had regular tomatoes through the summer, not producing in that. Well, he planted, Fred found a microclimate. Planted early. He should have everything out of there by mid-July, and just as the real heat is coming on. And this is a way that you can make use of challenging areas like this. It's also a way that you can make more efficient use of your garden if you're limited for space. Determinant tomatoes all tend to ripen together. I grow one every year just for this purpose. It's called Principa Borghese. It's one that's grown for sun drying. Grow the plant, compact plant, produces 100 little fruit, and you harvest them all, and you give them to the person who likes to sun dry the tomatoes, and you pull out the plant, and it's early August. So you can now plant those long cabbages or the Brussels sprouts or the things that need to get in early, or in his case, it has enough time for popcorn. You're not trying to get the plant to produce tomatoes all season. Of the varieties that I sell at my garden center, I estimate 95% or more are indeterminate, meaning the plant is a vine that keeps growing even until it's finally killed by freezing weather. So your basic tomato and your basic early girl is an indeterminate tomato. Breeders have come out with bush versions, determinate versions of early girl, champion, and certain other of the very popular garden hybrid tomatoes. These are ones that will grow fast, flower, set early, ripen quickly. In the case of early girls, he says 54 to 65 days from planting, and then you pick them all over about a 2 to 3 week period and you're done, and your plant is done. Bush beans work the same way, so you're done with that harvest. You can now cut that plant off at ground level, get rid of it, and plant something else in that spot. So it allows you to double crop an area, allows you to get a freezer full of tomatoes, shall we say, or a canning's worth of tomatoes out of your garden, and then make use of the space for other things. It really can also save water, because bear in mind that while tomatoes like a lot of water, that is to say, a large number of gallons of water early in the growth cycle and all through the fruit development stage, you're done. Like the farmers in Yolo County, you stop watering when the fruit is ripening and you don't have to water anymore. If you're going to leave that area fallow, you're no longer applying water to it. So folks who are really concerned about the cost of water or wanting to conserve water may find determinate tomatoes are an easy way to get what they're after in terms of yield and still have less water use or perhaps space that they want to put into something else. You could cut those off and plant basil there and get a whole nother crop of basil. So determinate tomatoes, not as common in the trade. Be sure to ask or check the label, but they're a great way to go for an all-at-once crop, planting early in a difficult microclimate, or planting late. Let's say you pulled out those bush beans and they're all done in this July, and you go down and you see that the grocery store, for God's sake, has tomatoes out front right now. Okay, they're sitting out there in 10-inch pots, barely getting watered, half off. Well, grab one, put it in the ground, water it, and you'll probably get a good crop out of that one. So you can make use of this characteristic of being determinate, rapidly producing, and then being done. It's not what most people want. It's not what most people are thinking, but it does work in certain situations and enabled him to use a difficult microclimate.
Would that work with my potatoes? They're flowering now. Does that mean that they're getting ready to be done?
Potatoes flowering, yes, that's the beginning of tuber production. So when they're flowering, that they're going into the process. And yes, indeed, potatoes should be out of the ground by the end of July, for sure. You could go ahead and plant something in that spot to make use of this location. One of the things we run into our garden centers, we're always telling people, you know, you need to plant your Brussels sprouts in July or August. Those old-fashioned cabbages, the really big-headed ones, you need to plant those in August. How are you going to do that if your garden is full of tomatoes? So this is one way to make space. Potatoes, determinate tomatoes, and so forth enable you to start what we're now talking about, cool season vegetables, the ones that need to get in early. People come in September, October looking for Brussels sprouts. Go ahead. I've tried it, but honestly, I've never gotten good results if you plant that late. Hard to imagine that September is too late to plant something that's a cool season vegetable, but it is the case with certain things. But if you pulled out that early grill determinate bush version, you could go ahead and plant them.
All right. We have a letter here from Ken, who lives in Palo Alto, California. Good morning. Every summer, I get this moss-like growth in my lawn that is usually fescue and bluegrass mixture. Is there any way of preventing it? It seems to dry up midsummer and start up again in May. I love your show and all that great advice. And then Ken sent us two pictures.
Yeah.
And I don't see any moss in these pictures, Don. What are you seeing?
Right. From the pictures, what I see here is a really typical pattern of high temperature leading to fungus stress on bluegrass and sometimes on other turf grasses. And so back in the day when rye blue grass blends were the most common turf grass blends here in the valley, he's in Palo Alto, but here in the valley, we found that every summer, someone would mow short right before a hot spell. You'd get this kind of die out. You'd be watering for what the bluegrass needed. You get fungus. You get patches of fungus on it. In the old days, nurseries sold, lots and lots of fungicide for people to apply to their lawn to prevent these kind of problems. I don't think you have moss here. Although, if you would go ahead and get down and take closer pictures, sort of macro pictures of on the edge of where it's green and not green, the pictures are rather mottled, and that's a classic fungus pattern. I'm guessing that'll verify for us. People do get moss in their lawns, particularly in rainier climates. And in years when we have a lot of rainfall, you'll often see moss, but the moss is always in the shaded areas. Moss doesn't grow in full sun. Honestly, my standard answer to people who come in, which happens fairly rarely in our climate, but when they come in saying, I've got moss in my lawn, what do I do about it? I say, if moss is growing there, your lawn isn't going to grow real well there because it's probably too shaded for it. So maybe think about something else entirely, or we can talk about what kind of grass is okay with more shade. I think what you're seeing here is a fungus disease that's hitting predominantly the bluegrass component of your lawn. That's why it's mottled looking. The other grass is unaffected. Fescue is generally not affected by fusarium. Bluegrass is, ryegrass is intermediate. So when people used to do this thing of cutting out a sample and bringing it in, I could show them on the leaf blade. This one is bluegrass. Notice how it's dying out at the base. When it's dying at the base, that whole plant is going to die. You'll have a dead patch of grass next to this healthy green one, shiny leaf. This is ryegrass, unaffected, hence the mottling pattern. You could spray fungicides. I don't think that's a good approach. In the long run, your best bet is to overseed with more fescue. Mm-hmm. And throwing some ryegrass in there, some of these new forms of perennial ryegrass. We sell one called Hat Trick. There's one called Fiji that are out there. Shorter growing, nice dark green color, which was not the case with ryegrass 30 years ago. We've got some really nice looking ones now. That'll come up more quickly. Change over your grass population of species to get ones that are resistant to fungus, and I suspect you will see less and less of this problem. We characteristically see this in the valley when someone has put in a sod lawn. And most sod, no matter what it's predominantly made of, whether it's mostly fescue or fescue with ryegrass or whatever, they almost always add some bluegrass because bluegrass, one, has the depth of color that is the standard for the industry. If you're comparing a new turf grass variety to what's out there, bluegrass is the color they want, that dark, dark green color. The other is that it has the ability to knit better. The roots knit together better, so it makes sod better than the other species. Fescue doesn't make a really good, well-connected sod. So they'll add some bluegrass just to make it roll up better, basically, make your sod function as sod better. It's maybe 10% in most sod mixes that I look at where they're using it. And so people roll out the sod, everything looks fine for a year. You have to water a lot because it's new sod. And within that first summer, and especially the second summer, little mottling sort of dies out in the sod. And I say, yeah, that's the bluegrass dying out. This just happens. Don't worry about it. And when it, you know, if it's a lot of it, then wait till fall, overseed, contact the sod company to find out exactly what kind of grass seed you're after. I can probably help you figure that out. And then just overseed in the fall, problem solved. So there is generally some bluegrass in a lot of sod that you purchase. So you'll see this mottling pattern in the summer. That's when these diseases hit. You've got a lawn that looks like it has a lot of bluegrass. And so it's time to start getting away from that. That's the easy long-term answer. You can go ahead and dethatch it. You can rake it out. When you do scatter the seed in the fall, I want it to be going down onto soil, not thatch or grass. So important to rake out that dead looking stuff by hand if you're able to. If not, go out and rent a dethatcher and that'll do the job. You can even pay a gardening service to do it. The seed that goes on should be going on to soil. So you have to rake out the dead stuff or it just won't work. Other than that, there's not a whole lot of prep you need. If they want to aerate the lawn at the same time, fine. They can rent a machine that does that. You top dress with compost. You generally put down some fertilizer when you do all this, and it works real well. If you do it when the weather is mild, going into the rainy season, if it doesn't work the first time, repetitive overseeding is one of the mantras at the Davis Garden Show. If it didn't work the first time, do it again 2 or 3 weeks later. Just throw some more seed out, especially when a storm is coming in. When rain is coming our way in October and November, I want to run home and throw seed out, whether it's grass seed, meadow seed, wildflowers, you name it. That's a great time to scatter seed because you don't even really have to worry about covering it at that point. If you do it in warm weather, which is common in October, or there's a north wind coming, a top dressing of compost is a little bit of insurance against the grass seedlings drying out as they germinate. Other than that, there's not a whole lot to this except that the seed needs to be on soil and you need to water it until it's up and established. So you do it at a cooler, milder time of year.
This is not Ken's issue, but wouldn't it help if you didn't mow so short?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like this is mown quite short.
Well, that's actually normal. We're
at 3 inches, aren't we?
Yeah, and it's very hard to set mowers at 3 inches. It looks like a normal mowing height of 2 inches, which is okay until we hit the 90 degree temperature range, and then it stresses things. If you can't adjust your mower and you can't really, you know, can't change the mowing height, if it's about to get hot, don't mow. Just wait through the heat. Here in the Valley, that makes sense. Palo Alto is a little bit different climate, but here in the Valley, you know, we know that this weekend it's going to be 101 on Saturday. Don't mow on Friday. Don't mow on Saturday. Wait until we're through and going into the other direction of our typical pattern of high temperature, several days of cooler temperature, high temperature. Don't mow right before hot weather. Don't mow before a north wind, because you can have, aside from the added stress of the wrong species being in there, fescue, which is the grass group that we strongly prefer for turf, has a high growing point. What that means is if you go down on your hands and knees and you pull up a grass plant, you can see where it's growing from. In the case of bluegrass, ryegrass is growing from about a half inch above ground. In the case of fescue, it's 1 to 1.5 inches above ground. If you mow off the inch above that, and then a dry wind comes along, many of the individual plants in the population that you call your lawn will desiccate and die. Not all of them. So it'll thin out, and it can thin out really badly if you mow right before an extreme heat wave or a dry wind. It thins out not so badly, but still visibly if you mow right before temperatures are in the upper 90s. And it's the fescue that's affected by that. It's just literally drying desiccation of the growing point. It's not a disease at that point. I can show people when they bring in a sample, but you can see it yourself. Learning to inspect the individual grass plants can be really fascinating. There's a reason I don't play golf. I would spend all my time on the golf course down on my hands and knees, looking at the grass, going, look, there's a weird kind of bent grass over here, guys. Don, we need to play on through. People are waiting. So I would be looking at the turf because it fascinates me the different ways these grasses grow. I mean, Bermuda grass runs across the ground. Growing point is at ground level. One of the reasons it's so, you know, so tough. Fescues are 1.5 to 2 inches up above ground level. So they're more vulnerable to temperature extremes. Other than that, fescues are our best choices. They're deeper rooted, they're lower water tolerant, and so forth. But if you inadvertently stress the whole turf simply by mowing it right before a hot, dry or windy spell, you can thin your lawn out really badly. Easy answer to that is just overseed it with more fescue when we get into the right weather for doing that. So one of the things I often find myself telling people in July when they're bringing me these pictures is, if you can tolerate this appearance, keep your lawn watered adequately through August and through September, because it's still hot, dry, and windy here in September. In October, you can solve this problem. You don't want to spray it with anything now. There's no need to fertilize it now. That really won't help. Just correctly water it, you know, one good soaking twice a week, and not more often, not shallow waterings, deeper watering, little surface drying between waterings and so forth. And just wait until we're in proper seeding weather, which is mid to late October. Month of November is fine. Even into December works very well. Then you'll be okay. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of work and you'll have just more risk as you try and do it in hot or dry weather.
So when you say to rake out, because you want the seed to be on bare dirt, you don't want to do any of that raking or dethatching or any of that stuff now.
No.
And then leave it sit for a couple of months, because wouldn't you get awful weeds coming in?
Well, it'd be worse. You'd be exposing even more of the growing points to desiccation. Yes, when you have bare soil, you're inviting weeds. That's the other problem. If you have a problem with spurge, purslane, things like that, to some degree, crabgrass, a lot of weeds are there because of open soil, and weeds are opportunists. You've made a condition that's favorable to them. Someone was asking if the lawn is thinning out, should I get it dethatched right now? Well, that would not be optimal. One thing you can do at any time is go get some compost. Doesn't really matter what it is, honestly. If it has fertilizer in it, great. If not, that's okay too. And go ahead and rake that over your lawn. You know, just spread. Have you ever noticed how you spill some potting soil in one area, the grass really flourishes over there? Go ahead and take that compost, throw it out, rake it out, get it just an eighth or a quarter inch on the, water it in. Yes, you're burying some grass blades, but I can assure you they'll pop right back up through. And that will have the advantage of protecting the exposed roots a little bit, protecting that growing point a little bit on the fescue, the plants that have that high growing point, and perhaps enriching the soil as well. Certainly it'll enrich the soil in the sense of breaking down and slowly, making better root zone. In many cases, it also has, almost every compost you buy now has some kind of fertilizer in it, and that'll help as well, but it's a gentle fertilizer. I don't want you throwing 25% nitrogen out there in July when it's hot, but a top dressing raked in and watered in of compost can actually be very beneficial. By the way, it looks better. So if you're having people over, maybe 3 or 4 days ahead of time, rake some compost out over the surface and water it all in really thoroughly, and your lawn will look better than if you just left it bare and showing that stress from having mowed too short. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Yeah, check out some of the new programming here at KDRT. The Yolo County Breakdown is brought to you by DJ Rocky Outcrop. From Bill Monroe to Billy Strings, the Yolo County Breakdown is a journey through bluegrass and newgrass music, acoustic string music in the spirit of American roots and country that was born through the genius of Bill Monroe and his bluegrass boys, but which has spread and flowered to be an art form that is uniquely American. The Yolo County Breakdown is live Fridays 10 to 11 a.m., replays a couple times during the week, so for the rebroadcast time, just click on the schedule guide.